November 26th, 2009. I am Isaac Junipier, and I am the interviewee, and I am going to interview today Sonia Sager in Eagle, Alaska, at Sonia's residence. And Sonia, I got a bunch of questions that I want you to answer, and if you don't want to answer any of these, you don't have to.
Okay.
And one of the first questions on historical overview, personal background is, where were you born and grew up?
Okay, I was born... I have two little kids sitting on my lap, so that's probably what you're hearing here. But I was born near the old red barn in Eagle at a house on Berry Street. And that was in 1979, July 13th. And I was my mother's first child, so she came up from downriver at Trout Creek where we were living so that she could have me. Syriana. Mike. Syriana just knocked out all the paperwork. Oh. Here, let's push stop for a minute. Okay.
Where were your grandparents born, grew up?
Okay, that's kind of complicated. My mom and dad came to Alaska in 1974 from Munich, Germany. And my grandparents were born in, my grandma was born in the Ukraine, my grandpa was born in Hungary, my other grandpa was born in America, and my other grandma was born in Germany. So they came from a lot of different parts of the world, and it was all mixed up during World War II. They met, married their respective partners, and had children that they raised in Munich. So my dad was actually an American citizen because he was born in Detroit, and that's part of the reason that he later came to Alaska.
What were your great-grandparents born, grew up?
Ooh, great-grandparents. They were on my maternal side. My great-grandparents lived in the Ukraine, and they were people who farmed and worked with horses. My great-grandpa, Emmanuel Montai, spent most of his life in the Russian Gulag as a prisoner working to complete the Trans-Siberian Railroad. And my other great-grandparents lived in Hungary, and they were farmers and hussars, which are people who fight on horseback. And then on the American side, I really don't know much about my family. On my dad's maternal side, they were postmasters in Bavaria.
What can you tell about the origins of your family, family and people?
Well, I could tell a lot, but it would take, you know, hours to tell, and there's a lot to tell. You know, everyone during World War II had their own story. My grandma, Selma Frank, was a refugee when she was 12 years old, fleeing from the Ukraine through battle zones, you know, back and forth. And there's a lot of stories, some that you can be proud of and some that I'm definitely not proud of. But I won't tell them all here because it's just too long. So.
Are there any old beliefs, customs, traditions practiced by you or your family that remains important? And if so, might you be willing to describe them?
Yes, there's quite a few. A lot of them are German traditions, like making Advent wreaths at Christmas time, which hang, the whole wreath is suspended by four ribbons and the candles sit on top of it and you light one on every Advent Sunday. And then there's Nikolaus, which is a holiday on the 6th of December where the German sort of Santa Claus figure comes and puts something in your muckluck or in your boot, some small treats. That's the 6th of December. And then there's a lot of Easter traditions like blowing out eggs and decorating them, hanging them on pussy willow bouquets and things like that. And all those kind of traditions are still really important in our family.
Okay. What crafts or other specialized activities do you do?
Speaking of Nikolaus, this guy's Nikolaus.
Yes, our kids really love Nikolaus. But Findus, you have to wait just a second, okay? And then you can. Specialized crafts. Mostly in my family, I guess it would be mostly stuff with wood, because my dad does a lot with wood, and so I suppose like building things, and we do a lot of drawing. My mom is an artist, and she kind of passed that on to us, so wood and painting and drawing probably, mostly.
How would you describe your identity, such as your beliefs, your ancestors, your culture, and your connection to the land or community, your language, and a combination of these?
Okay, well, I grew up speaking, for the first 4 years, I spoke German. He can sit on my lap. But I'm born here in Alaska, and so my main identity is not at all European. It's Alaskan, and it's very closely linked to the Upper Yukon, where I grew up, and here, Eagle, which is about 40 miles away from Trout Creek, which is where I grew up. And so, to me, my identity is pretty firmly right here, with family, you know, a lot of my family living here, dogs. I do have a small part of my cultural identity that's definitely European, including, you know, my cousins and grandma and stuff like that. So I guess as far as language, I really appreciate the native languages like Han and Gwich'in, and I like to try to learn a little bit of those when I can. And also Inupiaq, because our adopted daughters are Inupiaq. So the main language around here for doing things in is English, but it's not the only one that's important for this area.
Part 1B is historical overview, community background. What do you know about the Eagle distance past? About Eagle's distant past.
Oh, about the distant past. I don't know as much as probably I should, but I do know quite a bit. Personally, people like Flossie and Nellie and Max have told me a lot of stories that make me feel connected to here, and they've shown me a lot of the pictures of, of you guys when you were young, growing up. So I have that part of me. I can always think of those pictures and how it was, and that makes me feel connected to the area. I also have a lot of friends here, you know, spending all this time growing up. I moved here when I was about 7 or 8, and before that I lived downriver, and we still came to Eagle as our nearest town quite, you know, often. So I feel like I have a very good connection. And what was the question again?
What do you know about Eagle's distant past?
Oh, the distant past. Yeah, well, I do know quite a bit about it, and I've read quite a bit about it. I think that you can't live here and not know a lot about the past. There's museums everywhere. The part of the past that you can miss a little bit if you don't go out of your way to learn about it is the native culture and people who lived here before Gold Rush people came, and that's what interests me the most.
How have mining activities in the area affected life in Eagle?
Did you say mining?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, as far as what you just mentioned, the past was obviously completely affected by mining, and it brought these waves of prospectors, so it did have a great effect, you know, in the past. And it, at this point, I think that there's not very much mining activity here right now, so I don't know how much effect it has right now, except for obviously affects a few streams here where it's still practiced, but in the past, of course, it affected everything. And personally, I always hope that when somebody does mine, they take the fish habitat into consideration. That's my main priority.
Are there any old stories about floods that you know about?
Yeah, everybody has some kind of a flood story. My personal one, when I grew up at Trout Creek when I was a little kid, I remember sitting on the porch and seeing the big ice chunks coming through the trees, and we headed for the hills. But it was a lot easier to move things back then. You didn't have so much to move, and it just, you let the dogs loose and you moved your stuff, and that was about it. luckily the house survived that flood. We had a special place where we would watch the floods from up on the hill. And as far as the flood that happened this year, obviously, I'm sure Nellie's the one to talk to, and she said when that happened that she hadn't seen anything like this yet, so I figure I haven't seen anything like that yet either.
When she mentioned that Nellie Briggs is the oldest resident here in Eagle, and Nellie is 92, 93 years old. What role has the church played in the development of Eagle?
Well, I'm probably the wrong one to talk to about the church developing Eagle, but I know that there has been a lot of history with that, and I'm sure there was a lot of different missionaries, you know, that I wouldn't know the names of. I'd have to ask somebody else.
What role has the school played in the development of Eagle?
School. The school has been a sort of, over the years, a gathering place, I guess. It used to be out in the village. Before that, it was near that red barn that I was talking about where I was born, right downtown. And so there's probably over the years, it's played a community kind of role. But more than that, I'm sure it's changed the way that people's lifestyles, because they had to stay near the school and send their kids to school and stuff like that. So I was only enrolled in this school once I was about 10, and before that I was homeschooled downriver.
How do you feel that life in Eagle has changed with the coming of new residents?
Oh, well, that's, I think it has changed every time there's, you know, a decade goes by or a wave of people. And when I was a kid, we were the kids of the people that came in the 70s that were young, almost hippies, I guess you could say, you know. And they lived downriver and out in the woods and trapped and all this kind of stuff. And they had kids. A lot of them left, though, when the kids got old enough to need some serious schooling or, you know, they left this lifestyle behind and went to the city. And my parents didn't leave. So I got to stay and see the next wave of people, which was older people coming to retire and enjoy their, you know, retirement years or raise their grandkids or something like that. So it's gotten a lot, the spring carnivals have gotten a lot milder, the dating scene has gotten a lot less hopping.
How do you think that tourism has changed, has affected the community of Eagle?
I think tourism has, you know, always, when I was a kid, I was really anti-tourism because that's just how I grew up. And as I grew older, I just realized that it does give people a pride to sell their wares down there and at the stands where they sell their jewelry and things. And it does give Eagle a kind of a special feel that people come here and enjoy the museums and enjoy the just enjoy the community. I think so far, at the current level, it's still manageable. I wouldn't want to see it go too far, you know, to the point where I don't really need to see a bunch of hotels pop up or anything like that. That wouldn't be very nice. But at this point, I think it's still maintainable, with maybe the exception of that. The Yukon Queen, in my opinion, is a boat too big for this river. But I think that, you know, I do like the fact that there is a boat that runs between Eagle and Dawson. That's great. I just question the design.
Is the Yukon Queen so
what
big
draws
in the river with pink kids, you said?
And this is going to be the interview, so you have to wait.
What draws new people to Eagle, and what causes residents to decide to leave?
I think what draws people to Eagle, from my perspective, is probably the romance of it and the fact that, in some cases, the fact that you can do your own thing without being scrutinized, without being watched very carefully. And then what causes people to leave is probably the isolation or the lack of job opportunities, lack of health care, I would say.
What is your opinion of the leadership of Eagle, and what might you suggest? What ideas might you have?
Well, I think that the reason that Eagle doesn't have a very strong, united kind of leadership is because people come here because they want to do their own thing. If they live here, they would like to lead their own household and do their own, life things. They don't necessarily want to take the time to lead everybody else or to be led around. So I think that it's a good question. We definitely could use a little more leadership, but when you have a group so small that it's less than 200 people, that becomes difficult, especially when you have people that have really different views, you know, and different cultures, different ways of life. You know, you have to have a group that's got some common goals and things. So I think we have leadership when we really need it, probably, but otherwise it may be hard to come by, probably.
What other historical events do you feel important to Eagle's past?
I think there's a lot, but I would probably start way back. I think that the history in the museum should be expanded back a couple hundred years further, or maybe even further, because Eagle was a really important area even for people, prehistoric people, and I think that those events are really important, as well as just the flu epidemic that occurred that killed so many people in the late 1800s. That's really neglected as a historical thing. And, you know, those events like Amundsen coming here, that's nice, but that's really a few weeks out of years of history. So I think those small events get a lot of attention compared to really larger issues that are sometimes overlooked. But I think there's a lot of important events. Probably the end of the gold rush was a big deal. You know, everybody pulled out eventually, except for the people that are still here.
Part two will deal with subsistence and employment in Eagle. What kind of work have you done in the past while living in Eagle?
I mostly did subsistence things and working for my own family, but I have had a couple smaller jobs. I worked for AmeriCorps, and in that capacity I worked for the village, and I worked for the school for years teaching art or tutoring. So those are probably the main ones.
How would you describe this employment opportunities in Eagle?
Pretty slim, but there is opportunities. It's just a matter of, do you want to tie yourself down to a job that's going to, you know, take that much time or commitment? Like, there's things like school janitor, a lot of things like that, but where I'm at in my life right now, raising my children is the most important. You don't want me to talk. And yes, so there isn't a lot of job opportunities.
What does subsistence mean to you, and how do you participate in subsistence activities in the Eagle area?
I think subsistence is very important to our family. We, first of all, in the spring, we make a garden, and we eat off that all summer, and then harvest the things for winter. We pick berries, low bush cranberries in the campground area. That's really important. Those trails back there should never be developed. They're really important for cranberry picking. And then we pick blueberries up on the summit. It's really important to us to have the access up there to pick berries. We do that in August. And then in July, king salmon fishing is really the most important activity. In the fall, chum salmon fishing for the dogs is really important. And then moose, the caribou hunt, the moose hunt, and dog mushing. Those are all the main things right there.
When do you hunt?
Oh, trapping too, but I think my husband will address that more.
When do you hunt, fish, trap, collect, and why at the time of the year? And that time of the year, like you do berries in the summertime. And
yeah,
in the fall.
I think I almost said that a little while ago.
I think you answered that.
Yeah, I tried to. I'd like to say that the few days of the moose hunt where it's only for locals later in the season, those are really good for the local people. The more time there could be there where there was hunting just for rural residents, I think the better. The caribou hunt right now is kind of a disaster. We're getting a lot of people in that aren't local and that are eating them all. So we got some restrictions on fishing off and on. That's always hard, but we're willing to deal with those to try to increase the stock, or to maintain, I guess, the stock, I should say.
How have state and federal regulations helped or hinder your activities as subsistence user?
Well, that's a really long answer. I think Mike could give a better one than I could, and so I'll just give a short one, which is sometimes they do hinder it. I'm not fond of fish and game personally. I think that they manage the resource basically just to get the maximum amount of people to harvest the maximum amount of things, and I'm completely against aerial predator, wolf control, that kind of thing. Really bothers me. I personally, I just think that I'm willing to live with a lot of rules if they're for the good of the actual game population, and so that we can use it in the future if it's sustainable. And I really believe in a rural preference for subsistence.
How has state and federal regulations affected community subsistence activity?
Well, it obviously hinders it at sometimes, especially, you know, if you're restricted on fishing or something like that. But if they were doing it in the instances such as, like, cutting down on the number of days you can fish for chinook or the mesh size, I believe that's the correct thing to do, because we want to have, you know, enough escapement to meet our treaty obligations with Canada, as well as to ensure that we get some more fish. But what this is combined with is, at the same time, they're, you know, having commercial fisheries and eating all our fish out of the ocean. So I wish that they would just manage things better, is all I can say. You know, I wish that instead of trying to farm moose up here and kill all the wolves, they would, you know, just think about sustainability, trying to have, you know, have enough moose for people who really need them, local people, and that's, I just disagree with how it's managed sometimes, and I don't really, I disagree with the fact that every time that a governor gets elected, the whole Board of Games changes. It's way too political. I think scientists should be listened to more, their actual data should be more listened to than it is, and that's what I think.
What ideas do you have for Eagle's economic stability?
I don't have a lot of ideas about that, but I think developing small business opportunities is probably the way to go. There's some people here that do guided dog mushing trips and stuff like that, and there's canoe businesses, and there's jewelers, and those small businesses they do provide stability. Those people stay here, they live here, and they spend their money here, you know. So.
Do men's and women's do the same kinds of work in Eagle, or do they tend to do different kinds of labor? What about in the past?
Well, I don't know so much about the past, but I know that people like Flossie sure did anything a guy could do, and usually better. But as far as right now, I think that men and women, it just differs from household to household, you know, and how they like it. In our family, women do whatever guys do if they want to, you know. They hunt and build things, and I built this house. And but the guys get to do that too, you know, so everybody gets to do the subsistence stuff, and everybody gets to wash dishes, and that's how I would like to see that.
Here again, Sonia was referring to Florence. That was Florence Johnson, who was an elder here, and she has recently, within the past year, passed away. Part three we're going to do with the experience of flooding and climate change. Were you here in 1975? Can you tell me about the land and the weather, what the land and weather was like?
Well, I wasn't here in 1975, 4 years later. Twinkle in my father's eye.
Thank you. Were you here in 2000? Can you tell me about the land and what the weather was like?
Yes, the 2000, I remember that year really well because my son was born that year, my first child. And when I say I remember it well, I mean I remember what happened to me that year. And John Borg has all that weather data, you know. So that's a person to ask about that. But I remember a few things about, you know, special years, the wildfires, you know, I remember that kind of thing more specifically than 2000. Nothing about 2000 sticks in my head as being extremely memorable, but it's just because I've forgotten it.
Were you here during the flood of 2009? What happened then?
Oh, yes, I was here. What happened was we had really incredibly thick ice, and that ice was still very thick. I think John Borg was saying it was still 4 to 5 feet in most places when spring came, when May came. And we had, just a moment, we had a really hot week of weather prior to breakup, so all the snowmelt off the mountains and everything poured into the river at once, and these huge chunks of ice just jammed up, obviously, once they got moving. And my husband was just thinking, you know, this is the day it's going to go out, and it did. And then once it jammed, it really flooded, as you know, quite terribly. And the ice just, you know, there's a lot of detail to, you know, how it came up and all that, but basically it just came up 30 feet more than normal, I guess, is what I hear.
What do elders say about erosion, flooding, and storms?
Well, what do elders say about that? Well, I think that climate change just, it kind of means that things are going to be a little more erratic, but I think that there was always flooding off and on. There was always a bad breakup. That's what I hear, you know. But it may get more frequent. Obviously, the trees on Belle Island that were taken out by this breakup, they must have been a couple hundred years old or something like that. So you can see that that doesn't happen all the time. But I think elders, even elders that are very old, are young compared to what the earth does. You know, I mean, 100 years is nothing for the earth. So just because we haven't seen a flood like that, I'm sure it's happened before, you know. It doesn't mean it hasn't happened. But I'm sure some of the elders here would remember what their, you know, grandparents told them. That might be more helpful because, you know, gotta look way back for those things.
How has the community reacted to floods in the past? Evacuation, moving houses, protecting kids, elders?
I remember one, the last major one when I was about 12 or something like that, was when it was before the wall was built, the retaining wall in front of the store, and so a lot of the bank there was taken away and the benches were taken, the ice was running even with the road. There's some video of that in the library, and the village was partially flooded. I remember we paddled around with a canoe there, you know, getting a few things, but the houses weren't damaged as far as they weren't moved or wrecked. And so people left to safe places, higher ground, and it was more of a exciting time. It was nothing like this, you know, the homes were not actually destroyed, so it was a lot more camaraderie and excitement rather than complete devastation.
Do you notice changes in temperature, snowfall, rain, rivers, lakes, or ponds in the local area?
Well, I feel like I'm just not old enough to answer some of these questions, but, you know, I do notice that, yes, sometimes the summers seem a little different as far as the lack of rain. We had those few summers and then those huge wildfires. That was pretty severe, and, you know, we've had a lot of winters where it was just really warm. Ben, can you go play upstairs just for a little bit? Because you're being noisy.
Here, Shen, you can take my place.
Please describe what the river and the region means to you in practical and personal terms.
What In both ways, it means pretty much everything, because personally, this whole part of the Upper Yukon from about the Kandik up to Dawson is, that's where, you know, my heart is at home. That's where everything is. That's like the center. People who live near the ocean probably feel that way about the ocean. And here we feel that way about the Yukon. And it's a way of travel. We can't travel if the, you know, in the winter we travel on the frozen river, in the summer we travel on the unfrozen river. And it's a place to swim, take the kids, they go swimming there, they play there. It's a place to get food, you fish there. It's a place to work. My husband works for the fish sonar for, you know, counting salmon. It's a place to hunt, that's where we hunt our moose. Basically, everything happens in or around the river, and so it couldn't be overstated how important it is. This place would be just another valley and a hill without the river, but it isn't. It's a really important place and always has been for people, you know, back through the ages.
How could that be possible? Okay, the interview's on again. What is your overall opinion of the Yukon Tree River's National Preserve?
When I was a kid, there was no preserve, and we lived in what is now the preserve at Trout Creek. And we didn't own that land, so when the preserve was made, it put a bunch of restrictions on us as far as it really made us feel that our future there was uncertain as far as were we going to be able to stay, were we not. And that was part of the reason that we moved to Eagle. Is it working? It looks like it's working.
Can I say something to you? Are you not allowed to live in national preserves?
What has been the most positive thing about...
Wait, hold on. I got to back up a minute. I better finish that question because I don't think I really finished it. I think that I feel a lot more positive about the preserve now than I did, but I'm still very... I really want it to stay a preserve. I don't need it to be... I want to be able to retain the right to hunt there, to fish there, and to stay there when we want to, especially in the cabins that we built and the places that we ran as, or that my dad ran as trap lines, things like that. I really feel that people should have access to it for subsistence use, and there should be nothing. There should also be no permanent campsites made there. I think making permanent campsites, like with a, you know, little camping pits and picnic tables, that's just, that should not happen there.
Finn,
you have to go upstairs.
Are you not allowed to live in Nashville?
That's not what I said. Can you please go play? Yeah, I guess that is how I feel about it. I think that it should stay the way it is. As their mission should be to keep it the way it is, pretty much, and let local people and other people enjoy it, you know, and use it.
What has been the most positive thing about the preserve since its establishment?
I think the most positive thing is probably the fact that it has, to some degree, managed to preserve that area. There's inholdings of land there that are owned by private people, but it does preserve it from, what I'd like to preserve it from is mineral exploration, basically, and that kind of thing. So that's been positive, and the negative has been people being displaced from there and only being allowed to stay in their cabins for, you know, 3 months at a time or something like that. So the loss of the people from the preserve has been the negative, probably.
What do you know of the people who live in the preserve since the establishment, and what other opinions of the preserve, if you know and are willing to share with us?
Well, I know pretty much everybody who's lived there, I mean, since I was born, and who lives there now. And I guess what I can mostly say about it is I'm willing to share any information I have about it. It's no secret that many people had differences with the preserves, like Dick Cook, of course, you know, and he had a right to have differences. I think that the main thing that the preserve did wrong at the beginning was they really came in fairly heavy-handed and tried to eradicate the human presence from the park. And I think that now there's more of an understanding that people can actually be stewards of the land, people can watch out for the land, people can clean up their own trash and live in a place, kind of enriching the place at the same time as using it, you know, respectfully. So I think that now that has changed a little bit, and people are understanding that it's great to have a warm cabin to stop in if you're traveling down there, if you're hunting there. It's great to be able to use the cabin that was built, you know. And that's how the people down there, when I was growing up, always were. They were always wanting to let other people use their cabins if they were traveling, as long as you supplied more wood and stuff like that. So I think as close we can stick to those older ways, you know, where you just try to help each other out, and the better. Kind of lost track of the question there. I don't know what it was.
Do you make use of the preserve for hunting, fishing, or trapping, or any other activity?
Yes. My dad still, to some degree, maintains some of his trap lines down there. I know that. And then for hunting, absolutely. Every year, very, very important, you know, to us to be able to hunt there and to fish there. So that's completely important. We applied for all the permits and whatnot to let them know that that was important to us.
What activities, what advice do you have concerning the preserve and its management?
I think I already went over some of it, but the main thing that I could say is, you know, please keep it how it is. Don't make any permanent campgrounds that need to be maintained and attract, you know, trouble bears or cause a great impact. Just keep it how it is. People can camp or stay in the cabins when they need to and want to. Also, I really appreciate the fact that they allow people like my dad to keep up his cabins that he built, because nobody has more vested interest in a place than the person who built it. And if you let them, they'll keep that place up as long as they can. Their family will take care of that place indefinitely, and it won't cost the government a dime, you know. So I think that's great. I'd say main thing, just do not let people get greedy and start to explore the oil shale or something and start poking around for natural gas. Like, hands off, you know, that's what a preserve should be. And as for any other advice, I'd say watch out. Don't let people expand their predator control program into your area, you know, and maybe exert a little more pressure to try to keep the fish and game from making these really radical plans that might totally unbalance your ecosystem. That's one thing. And then the only other thing is just listen to the people in that area. Don't try to make it like the other parks in Lower 48 where you try to funnel people through there. That's not what this is. This is a preserve. It's meant to be there for people who seek it out and enjoy it, but it's not meant to be something where you channel people through there like a funnel and try to show them, you know, everything. That's not the way. It's for people who want to find that, you know. So no West tours through there.
Can you describe any of the trails in the area? And what do you know about the use of these trails in the past and present?
Well, there's several really important trails, starting with the Ford Lake Trail, which starts at Ford Lake and goes behind Calico to come out right above the 70 Mile River. That's really important in the winter to dog mushers and to travelers. There's also the Lord Lake Trail, which after you cross from the Ford Lake Trail to the other side of the river, the Lord Lake Trail, which has been recently restored after the burn, will bring you right to Sheep Creek. And then there's a lot of other smaller important trails, including old trapline trails that go up the valleys and rivers around there. So there's a lot of different trails important to individual people and groups.
Part 5 deals with the future of Eagle. When you think about the future of Eagle, what do you see?
I don't know. I don't really see into the future usually, but I'm hoping for another wave of younger people, maybe. Some younger people. I think we need some younger people either coming back to where they grew up or coming here to from somewhere else, just because, you know, that will liven up the community a little bit, I think. I hope.
Can you think about and then list the infrastructures you would want in the village, town?
Yeah, I think what I could really see being important probably is like healthcare facilities for people. A nice new clinic maybe, you know. Not that I'm saying that trailer isn't good, I haven't seen it yet, but I'm just saying, you know, that might be a place to start, or something for elders. A place where people can shower might be nice. I don't know, you know, it's endless. You could even build a pool if you had enough money, and the kids could learn to swim so they wouldn't drown in the river.
There has been a lot of talks about sustainability. Can you tell me what this means to you?
Yeah, sustainability means that you can keep doing it year after year. So that's why I'm opposed to the that's why I'm opposed to the aerial wolf control plan, is because I don't think that you can take, you know, 70% of a population year after year, or even once, and have it be sustainable. I think sustainability means everything's connected. You can't just knock out one player in it. And, it means you have to sometimes adjust your behavior to take less of something. Maybe take less fish so that maybe there'll be enough in the future, you know. That's what it means to me.
Are you interested in alternative energy for the area?
Yes, depending on what it is. There's the first thing I want to say about that is I'm absolutely not interested in anything nuclear. Like, my grandma, I think I mentioned at the beginning of this interview, came from near Chernobyl, so I am not interested in nuclear stuff, and there's a good reason for that, especially near a river. So take your little experimental nuclear plant somewhere else, Toshiba, you know what I mean? Or, you know, that's not the kind of alternative energy we need. I think I'm interested in anything that is sustainable and that doesn't wreck, you know, our way of life. I like solar, I like wind, the turbine in the river, I don't know if that's going to work or not, but we'll see. I think he's almost done with me.
Do you have any ideas about the future of Eagle and where it needs to go?
I just hope it kind of can, I hope it can renew itself fast enough. There's a lot of people that are getting older, and we need to be able to change with the times, you know.
There's a cute cat.
I know, it's a cute cat. I don't know what I would say about that. I think I probably don't have any really good ideas, but I plan to stay here, and my family is here, so I hope to see what is in store, you know, and do our best. I'm not a pessimistic person. I think the river, you know, people who lived along the Nile had problems too every year. So I think it's just one of those things.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Sonia for doing this interview today, and that to let her know that I appreciate it, and that I would love to, after I get it, work done on it, to give you a copy of this tape. And you have any other thing that you may want to add?
Oh, thank you, Isaac. Oh, I had fun doing it, and I know we didn't get into a lot of details, but I think that I hope you do interview a lot of people out in the village, because you know, it makes a difference to us, and no matter what the differences in culture are between, you know, people, we try really to be inspired, you know, by the olden days too, and we name our dogs stuff like Ojri, which means Gwich'in and Moon. So
Moon and Witches.
Okay, well, thank you.
Okay, I'll let my camera turn here.